Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, Dan Buchanan. Each week at this time, we visit with an author, an editor, or publisher from our region. We hope to find out a little more about his life, what prompts him to write, and give him an opportunity to read some of his work for us. Today, we're very pleased to have Dan Buchanan with us. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Dan grew up on a farm in Codrington, graduated from East Northumberland Secondary School in Brighton, and studied at the University of Western Ontario before beginning work in computer technical support. Though he worked in Calgary for a few years, he returned to Toronto in 1986, where he has been the in-house IT consultant for a downtown law firm ever since. Now, however, since he moved home in 2010, he supports their computer system by remote access and occasional in-the-flesh visits. His return to Brighton was motivated by his interest in the history of the area and the genealogy of his own family, and following upon this, the genealogy of other local families. He calls this community genealogy and publishes his findings on his website, www.treesbydan.com. Deeply involved in historical activities in his community, Dan was one of the founders of Brighton's History Open House, known as HOH, now in its fourth year. In 2013, HOH's focus on the story of Dr. King, one of Dan's own relatives, led to the writing of his book, Murder in the Family, The Dr. King Story, published by Dundurn Press in August 2015. Well, Dan, I know the History Open House presentation in 2013 prompted you to write the actual book, but did you suggest the topic as the focus of the HOH weekend that year? And if so, why? What was its special appeal?
The idea came out of an event at the first History Open House in February 2012 when Roger McMurray at Brighton brought in his collection of Dr. King family artifacts. I was blown away, and I just thought we should make that the center of another event, and Roger wanted to donate it to Proctor House, so we put together presentation and a ceremony for the next History Open House, and it was a very successful event. But in the process, I had to produce a PowerPoint presentation to give about the Dr. King story, and I had never done that before. After a week or so of struggling with it, I realized I didn't have enough information. So that's when I realized I had to write the story first. And I went and did the research, found the original documents, and basically 6 to 8 weeks wrote the story. After that, the PowerPoint presentation came in a few minutes. It was easy. And we did the History Open House. And afterwards, we got such a positive response from it. People were asking, okay, when are you going to write the book? That I thought, well, I hadn't really thought of it that way, but the story is there. It's satisfactory to me. I had known Beth Bruder of Dundurn Press because she has a cottage at Presqu'ile, and I presented it to her. So the process was long, a couple of years, and they agreed to publish it. A lot of work later and whatnot, the book came out. So that's where it came out of, really, the first open house.
Huh. And how did your family connection to Dr. King shape how you wrote that story?
Well, it's been in my family. We weren't supposed to know about it, but people talked about it. He was buried right in the front yard of the house. You could not kind of ignore
really?
It. Yes. So I knew that I had to do something with the story. It was really a matter of when. I was always interested in just kind of core history. I'd never really done anything about true crime. But I thought this might be a combination that would work. And I wanted to make it identify the story with me because I felt that would be a hook that people would enjoy in terms of the interest of the story. Since the connection is there and it's real, it was just a matter of telling the story.
You really piqued my interest when you said something we're not supposed to know. Like, why do you think that was?
Well, I grew up in the 50s there, and it was not something that the parents wanted the children to know about. It was the black sheep in the family. It was a blot on the family's honor. And my grandfather in particular just hated the story. So it wasn't really until I got into really doing history and researching the family trees and the local history stories came out of that. And so I learned a lot more about the King family and about the Ames family. And I collected a file on this story for years through my other work. So at some point with this collection from Roger, it was just, well, okay, we have to do this. Plus, after I moved back to Brighton, I started hearing things from people about this story. Bizarre things that have nothing to do with the story. Things that have handed down from generation to generation, mm-hmm. but were salacious and almost silly. So I said, we need to know what actually happened.
And I hope some of those incidents made it into the book.
That's... Yes, absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay, well, I'm going to ask you to read from your book, but before I do, just tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's a true story, so it's history. It's based on original documents. It is this story of Dr. King in 1858 who poisoned his wife in Brighton and was hanged in Coburg the next year. And he became the only person ever executed in Northumberland County.
Wow.
It was a sensational thing at the time. Again, in my book, and when I speak about it, I characterize it as the O.J. Simpson trial of the 1850s. it had a major impact around. I was able to take all those original documents, the pile of paper from the inquest, the newspaper reports of the time, and things that were written by people who participated in the story. There's a journal written by the policeman who was the gatekeeper for Dr. King in the last 2 months before he was hanged.
Wow.
Wonderful information.
Goldmine of information.
Yes. And Dr. King himself, he was an arrogant person. He wrote a 7,000-word confession.
Wow.
And all of that stuff has come down in the archives. So once I got into the real documents, I could see that this was a fantastic story. Aside from my family connection to it, it was just a really interesting story. And so while I used the family connection to kind of introduce the story, and that's what's at the beginning of the book, the story almost tells itself in terms of all these interesting twists and turns and the personalities and the period things that you see, which you'll see in one of the readings.
Well, let's hear some, shall we?
Okay. The first one is chapter 9, called The Autopsy in the Pickle Bottle. And this is after Sarah has died, and they have an inquest, and there is an autopsy being performed, which is very unusual in those days. So let's go ahead. Back in Brighton, the work of the autopsy focused on Sarah Ann King's stomach. There was much certainty around the community that Dr. King had poisoned his wife with arsenic, and it seemed obvious the stomach could provide evidence that could be used at trial. The doctors removed Sarah's stomach and placed it in a pickle bottle, the best vessel they could find to carry and protect the stomach. The problem was that when the stomach was placed in the pickle bottle, they could not find a cork or any proper seal for the top. When the coroner adjourned the coroner's jury late that night, he placed a piece of paper over the top of the bottle and wrapped a string around it. Not ideal, but the best he could do at the time. Even though the pickle bottle had been washed thoroughly before being used in this way, the exact details of these proceedings would be of intense interest at the trial of Dr. King. One of the arguments put forward by the defense was that someone could have inserted a large quantity of arsenic into the stomach after it was removed from the body. The opening for this argument was the method used to secure the bottle that first night.
Oh, good heavens!
Again, we need to remember this is 1858. And while they had their methods, they had their procedures, they had their systems, they were immature relative to what we understand. You know, a pickle bottle, for heaven's sakes.
And one without a lid, no
less. Yes, yes.
Are you going to read another short piece?
Part of the introduction to this story is my connection to it through my family and the fact that Dr. King was buried in the front corner of our yard and that it was handled through history. Because it stood up at the corner of the house until 1920. And my grandfather's mother had her sons bury it just to get it out of sight. And then in 1955, they needed to move it. Grandfather remembered where it was. And then they buried it in the garden. And 10 years later, my dad pulled it up with the plow.
Oh, good heavens.
And this little bit is about what my grandfather did after that. Here goes. But that was not the end of it, for the episode continued the next day. On Sunday morning, everyone went to church, except Grandfather. He saw Grandmother off on her short walk down the road to the Codrington United Church at the south end of the village. Then he waited until the rest of us had gone to church. He did not want any witnesses for what he was about to do. When the time was right, he put on his old coveralls, got into his Willie's Jeep, and drove up the road to the farm. When he arrived, he went directly to the shop and found his favorite sledgehammer. With a sledgehammer in the jeep, he backed across the garden to the edge of the lilac bushes. He dragged the two pieces of stone onto the garden behind the jeep. Then he took his favorite sledgehammer in hand and with deliberate and energetic determination proceeded to pulverize the two pieces of stone into hundreds of jagged pieces.
Oh, what a pity.
My grandfather hated this story.
Apparently, yes.
And being reminded of it one more time by this stone coming to the surface again was too much.
Yeah.
And he just wanted to end it.
Wow.
And so he took the pieces and buried them up on our pasture land just so nobody would ever find them.
But you won one over him, didn't you? Because it's all back up again.
Well, as I like to say, I'm sure he would be rolling over in his grave, but I also know that he loved a good story. He told stories a lot, and he might just be one of the first at the library to take it out.
Well, on that note, I think we'll take a short break. Okay. Thanks, Dan.